Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bob Elson. We're set as usual for our Sunday morning show. Remember that the White Sox are at home today to play the California Angels, a tough team, and a team that I think has got a very good chance to win the division. The addition of Rod Carew, who will help the club in many, many ways. Kansas City has been handicapped with injuries. The Texas club also has a shot, but I don't know. There's something about that club. They're so inconsistent. But anyway, try to get out and see the White Sox against California today. And as you know, the Cubs are on the road. Our guest today is going to be an old friend of mine, one of the great pitchers of all time, Bob Feller. Here's a fellow that really, in a 21-year career spent with Cleveland, built up some incredible pitching records. He tossed 3 no-hitters, pitched 12 one-hitters. He struck out 348 batters in a single season. He fanned 18 batters in a single game and wound up his career winning 266 games. Naturally, we're going to talk baseball with Bob. We'll be back in just a moment. We're delighted to have Bob Feller as our guest on our program today. He and I have been friends for a long, long time. He was elected to Baseball Hall of Fame in 1962 and richly deserved it. Bob, there have been some changes in the game of baseball since you were so active and since you compiled such a great record. For example, the grass and the synthetic turf and all that sort of thing. You think you'd feel any different if, and you look well enough to do it, if you're able to step out on the mound today?
Well, Bob, there have been a lot of changes, mostly, I presume, economic. The fundamentals are still the same. The artificial turf does make it harder for the infielders to field hard-hit ground balls. It increases the batting averages. Of course, the great double-knit uniforms and the big gloves. But the fundamentals between the two white lines, as you know, you still have to execute them. And I don't think the hitting's as good. I think the right-hand pitchers are letting the runners get a great, tremendous lead. No catcher could throw them out. And some very fine young ball players, and some older ones, too, playing. You know, got a guy like the old-timer, like Pete Rose, who I saw last night in Philadelphia. And the travel is different. We used to get to know all the news media people, replay the games on the train. Yeah. And those were great days when you could really have a lot of conviviality amongst the players on the train, and the news media people traveled with us.
Yes, today it's all so fast. You get on a plane and you're wherever you're going in an hour and a half or 2 hours.
Yes, it's kind of the 3 G's, as I say. It's kind of grab, gulp, and go. And it's more show business today because of television and the great media coverage. But nothing wrong with it. The great pension plan and the large salaries, the getting paid for your potential, not for your performance, which is not the way most of us used to do. We got paid after we did the job, or we thought we did anyway. But that's society today, and it's just with sports as well as it is everything else in our society.
The reason that Bob Feller is in Chicago has to do with the All-Star game, and he's doing some work for Gillette in promoting the balloting for the game, right, Bob?
Yes, I'm making cities like New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, and Atlanta. Lefty Gomez is making other cities around the country, promoting the balloting for the 1979 All-Star Game. We want to get a lot of ballots out in all the cities. We want it to be honest and fair. In Chicago, of course, you can pick them up, or any other city, at the ballparks at Wrigley Field or at Comiskey Park, and any retail outlet where the Gillette products are featured. So let your heart be your guide. You can write in a player if you want to, like I'm sure they're going to be doing in St. Louis for one particular guy, Lou Brock, who's having a great year, who's not on the ballot. So, well, we want to get in about 15 million votes this year. Last year they got in over 12. And so get your ballots, get your votes in. Have a great game coming up in the Kingdome. I'll be there. And I'd like to see the American League win one for a change. I'm old enough to remember when we used to win occasionally.
We used to win all the time. Back to, you know, I did the first World Series for Gillette. Great company, and I've been very friendly with that company all through these years. They're very, very sports-minded.
They certainly are. They've been in it since in the early 1900s, and they're still in it bigger and better than ever, and I'm glad to be a part of it. Of course, actually, some of the fans, I hope, would like to know what I really do, my real job. I work for the Hilton Hotel Corporation. That's my daily job.
Another fine company.
Thank you, Bob.
Bob, how do they avoid, or how are they going to avoid what's happened a few times, the business of stuffing the ballot boxes in different cities?
Well, Bob, I'll get into that in a moment. I could be facetious. We're in Chicago, you know. But the players used to elect the select the player who's just selecting all opponent team. And that worked pretty well. However, if you had a player on your team you wanted to be in there, you wouldn't vote for the number two man on the other club. You'd vote for number three or four guy, hoping your man would get it. So you wouldn't, by voting for somebody else who was in competition with the guy on your team, not voting for him, you would X out a vote for your man. You'd vote for the three or four guy. And it's happened. There's no perfect way. It did happen in Cincinnati when they selected eight of the players, seven of them were selected, except George Crow, the first baseman, didn't make it when they stuffed the ballot box. But this was done by a newspaper, by printing ballots, by the bales. And the commissioner stepped in, as you know, and made it right. But look, Rod Crew has been up there pretty high. And in Minneapolis and Minnesota, they haven't. There's not a large city, but it gets the fans involved, as you know. And there's no perfect way for any balloting. But this is the best way I know of to keep the fans involved. And I hope that your conscience and your heart be your guide. Be honest. Be fair.
At one time, I recall the players did the picking, and I saw a lot of advantage to that particular system, simply because I believe that a fellow like yourself or other ball players that I've known, you can't pick anybody on your own team. You have to pick them off the other side. You would sit down with a pen and pencil or whatever it was and a piece of paper and give a lot of thought to it to try to be fair to the fellows on the other side.
Yes, that is correct, Bob. But friendships, of course, it's a little politics involved. I think that was an excellent way to do it. And well, we want to keep the fans involved. This is a fans game, and the players are getting paid for it. I believe either way is good, but I think the best way to do it is the way you're doing it now. And the managers can select all the pitchers, the managers can select all the substitutes, and if there's any inequities anywhere along the line, and however they select them, the managers and his staff can try to close up those inequities. But I agree, it's a controversial subject, but I like to see the fans get involved, right or wrong, in making their choice.
I don't know whether you're aware of it or not. Maybe this isn't the right question to ask you, but who does originally put these names on the ballots? For example, Lou Brock, a great player that you and I both know very well, was left off. Who does the selecting originally?
Originally, they have some people from the commissioner's office and in the league offices of the National American League. They have some players and managers from all the major league clubs send in the names early in the year. It has to be done in early March, and it's possible a fellow could even be retired or released before the ballots come out. That's why there's plenty of room to vote for your favorite player. And it's very difficult to get the proper names in there. Like, I was left off the All-Star team one time. I just pitched my third no-hitter and had 11 wins and 2 losses. I didn't make it. And that was a time when Casey Stengel was selecting him. But it was just an oversight by Casey's part. I didn't blame Casey at all.
That really was an oversight. Tell me, what was it like at Cooperstown in 62 when you got into the Hall of Fame? As you know, I've been fortunate and been selected to get in this year on August the 5th, and it's a great honor, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, Bob, I'll be there with you. I always return to Cooperstown. I always have since I was selected. Even before I was selected, I used to attend the ceremonies in Cooperstown when my time permits it. And I think all the players and all the members of the Hall of Fame should always go back if their job and their health permits. Oh, it's great. You may shed a tear or two. There's a lot of nostalgia. You'll enjoy the commissioner's dinner the inductions, and I hope you return. You'll be doing a lot of autographing, and you'll really appreciate this. It'll be a change in your life because everybody knows you're a member of the Hall of Fame. It's a great honor, and it's a different thrill than winning an athletic event or a ball game. And boy, are we glad that you're going to be there. I'm looking forward to it just as much as you are, Bob.
Well, thank you, Bob, and I want to remind you our company, Northwest Federal, is giving a big cocktail party on that Saturday night. And we certainly want to see you there.
I just might go off the wagon for that, Bob.
Well, it'll be fine. Well, the All-Star game is, I think, a tremendous attraction. And I, like you, having spent so many years in the American League, have regretted what's been happening year after year.
Yes, Bob, I remember I was pitching. My first game was I went in to relieve Tommy Bridges in 1939 in New York with the bases full and made one pitch to Archie Vaughn, who hit into a double play and went on to finish the ball game. I pitched the last three innings. We won it. Remember those great hits that Ted Williams had in 41 in Detroit and 46 off the blooper pitch in Fenway. I got the win that year in 46, which is my greatest year.
Were you in Detroit? I broadcast that game with Ted Using when Williams hit that ball off a pass-off.
Claude Passeau. I was there. I pitched the first three innings of that ball game, Bob. I was sitting on the bench with my street clothes on. I was pulling for the ball to stay fair. It was only about 3 feet fair and very high.
Yeah, I remember.
It was a great thrill. But, see, DiMaggio grounded into what would have been a double play, but Kenny Keltner, our third baseman, knocked Billy Herman into left field, and his throw to first base to end the ball game was wide. That brought up Williams. Otherwise, DiMaggio would have ended it. And Ted stepped up and took advantage of this wide throw to first base and hit it in and won it for the American League. You remember that?
I remember it. I thought the ball was going into my room in the Book Cadillac Hotel. You remember how high that ball was?
It was very, very high, and it actually came down in, inside the park. It hit the top of the roof, which is, I think the ball had gone 375 feet, but it was about 500 foot high as well as 375 down the line.
Well, that was really some thrill. Our guest today, and we're delighted to have him, is an old friend, one of the great pitchers of all time, Bob Feller. We'll be back with our guest in just about 1 minute. Our guest today at Northwest Federal, and we're delighted to have him, is one of the great pitchers of all time, Bob Feller, who was born in Van Meter, Iowa. Is it true, the story they tell, that your father used to hang a tire over a tree and he'd get behind there with a catcher's glove and you try to get control by throwing it through that tire?
Well, most of that's the story. He did it for a while, but usually my dad just played catch with me out in the barnyard, and I used to roll the ball, a rubber ball, off the roof of the barn to practice catching fly balls. It'd come running down. I'd run around and catch it. But my dad was a great man. He was never a ball player. He's an Iowa farmer, and my mother was a great person, too. And they took. I was their only son. I have a sister, Marguerite, who lives down in Park Forest and works at St. James Hospital in Chicago Heights here, as well as my boy Bruce, who's up at Northwestern and teaching. But to get back to the farm, yes, my dad had a ball diamond on the farm. He also managed the team there, and that's the way I got started. He pitched batting practice to me. I had been playing ball ever since I was 5 years old. And when I signed a contract in Des Moines at 16 years old, the scouts assigned me Cy Slapnick. I came to Des Moines to see Claude Passeau and sign him for the Cleveland Ball Club. But he never did see Passeau. He came to take a look at me first. Claude Passeau went to the Pirates and later the Cubs. And, of course, I saw Claude pitching later on. A few years later, I was pitching against him. He's also a great pitcher, but Slapnick missed him and got me.
Bob, as you know, I broadcast some of the greatest games you ever pitched, including one here in Chicago, a no-hitter. And the game your mother attended, and unfortunately somebody fouled the ball and hit your mother right in the face and broke her glasses. Wasn't that it?
That's correct. That was Jackie Hayes, the second baseman for the White Sox. I was pitching. We had a big lead, and my mother, on Mother's Day, too, 1938 or 9, on Mother's Day, beautiful day, a Sunday afternoon, and my mother was sitting in the front row, and Jackie Hayes swung at a fastball late and hit her right in the eye, put her in the hospital for 2 weeks, had all kinds of stitches in her eyelid and her eyebrow. She never had any after effects from it, but it was a real shot, like you see at the ballpark when you don't want to look. You're afraid the ball might have hit someone in the face or in the body and injured them. I saw one last night in Philly. Then, of course, the opening day no-hitter, that cold day, which you broadcast, 1940, which Forsch almost pitched one on opening day, but he missed it by one day this year, so I still have the only one pitched on opening day. It was a 1-0 ball game when my catcher, Ollie Hemsley, and my roommate, Jeff Heath, teamed together with a double and a triple, won the game 1-0, and I was very fortunate in Comiskey Park. I won more games in this ballpark than any park in the American League except Cleveland. And, of course, I like the dimensions. It's a pretty good-sized park. And also, all my friends from Iowa used to always come in here to see the game and expect me to get passes for them. And I did.
What do you recall about the other no-hitters?
The one I think gave me the biggest thrill was after being in the Navy for 4 years, like you were, Bob. I came into New York my first start against the Yankees and pitched the first no-hitter ever pitched against the Yankees in Yankee Stadium. This was in 1946. That stadium was opened in 1953. And also the first shutout against the Yankees in over 2 years. My catcher, Frankie Hayes, who played for Chicago later and broke up a no-hitter of mine and got one, the only hit of the game, hit the home run against the Yankees in the ninth inning with one out off of Bill Bevins, who pitched a four-hitter. That was the only run of the ball game. In the ninth inning, all the Yankee fans were standing up cheering for me. And I had some pretty tough hitters at Tommy Henrick and Joe DiMaggio and Charlie Keller in the ninth inning. That was a great thrill.
Boy, I don't think you could pick out three tougher hitters.
No, Henrick was a real nemesis for me, and so was DiMaggio. Charlie Keller, I kind of had Charlie's number. He didn't like my curveball, but the other two fellas were pretty tough.
Speaking of Henrick, you know, I broadcast that game in Brooklyn with the missed third strike. You remember that story? And Tommy Henrik then came up with a base hit to right field to win the game?
Yes, Tommy was a great clutch hitter. That's why they call him the old reliable. Tommy could hit when the money was on the line, like Joe could. But he was one of the toughest hitters in the league, like Rip Radcliffe was for me right here in Chicago for a while, and later Taft Wright, who was the last man out, that no-hitter. He almost got a hit. Ray Mack, my second base, made a tremendous play in 1940, off on the grass to his left, and threw Taft Wright out. And those were really tough hitters, and you're always lucky when you pitch a no-hitter. And I had the 12-1 hitters. I guess maybe I can't say I was all unlucky in that, but some of them might have been either way. I know Lou Boudreau saved a no-hitter in New York that time with a great play on the first hitter of the ballgame.
I can remember broadcasting a game here in Chicago that, for the pitcher, was the toughest luck game I ever saw. Billy Pierce had a perfect game going with two out in the ninth inning. Not a man had reached, and there's two gone, and they send up a pinch hitter. I remember he was a catcher, Fitzgerald. He hit a ball down the right field foul line, and the ball hit just about 1 inch fair. And that kept Billy out of the Hall of Fame.
Well, Billy was a great pitcher. I pitched many a tough game against him. He was a very good pitcher. Not a big fellow like Tommy Bridges. Of course, he threw left-handed. Bridges was right. They had great stuff, a fine curveball, good live fastball. Was Fitzgerald, was this against the Washington Senators?
Yes.
This fellow Fitzgerald hit me real well, too, but he pulled me. He didn't hit me down the right field line. He hit me in the left field seats. He was a good hitter.
What about Hal Neuhauser?
Oh, yes, Hal and I had some great battles. In fact, last Sunday we had an old-timers game in Cleveland, and Hal didn't come, but a lot of Detroit players did. The older fellows that came over, and we had, like, Harry Eidenstadt, the guy that pitched against me when I struck out 18 and beat me, incidentally, back in 38. Hal was, I had a lot of battles. I was rather lucky against Hal. He was a lot better pitcher than his record against me shows, and he turned out to be a teammate of mine with that great pitching staff we had in 1954 when... In fact, that pitching staff, there's four members of that pitching staff, were on the same team. They're all in the Hall of Fame. Satchel Paige, Wynn, Lemon, and myself. We won 111 games. The Yankees won 103. Didn't even come close. But Hal was one of the greatest pitchers I ever saw.
Hypothetically, if you were pitching and there was a runner at second base and a tie score in the bottom of the ninth inning, and you had to have either DiMaggio or Williams up there, which one would you rather have up there?
I would sooner pitch to Ted. Ted was the greatest hitter I ever saw, but DiMaggio seemed to hit me better than Ted. There were certain pitchers that Ted didn't hit well at all. I'm sorry. There were certain pitchers that DiMaggio didn't hit well at all. There was nobody, including Neuhauser and the greatest pitchers in the game in both leagues, nobody that Ted Williams couldn't hit consistently. He hit me well, but DiMaggio hit me way above his natural average, and I finally got Joe where I could get him out once in a while, but then he retired.
You know, we had a lovely visit with Ted Williams the other day. He was in town for the morning. We got up and went out at the hotel around 6:30 in the morning and had breakfast with him and listened to his talk. And the other people there were not baseball people, but we were all interested in his talk about the philosophy of hitting.
Well, I'll say this much, Bob. Ted will take you at 7 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the morning around a hotel lobby or anywhere and talk about hitting. And I'll say he does know how to hit. And I saw him hit Rip Sewell's blooper pitch. It went 50 feet high in the 1946 All-Star game into the center field bleachers with all his own power, and he could hit that slow junk. He could hit my best fastball. That fellow could really adjust. He was the greatest hitter I ever saw. Of course, I never saw Larry Lazioi. And next to Ted, I pitched against this man, was Rogers Hornsby. He was the number two hitter in my book, the greatest hitter.
Well, he can well be. He hit over 400 twice with a dead ball.
That's right, and Hornsby was not a great infielder, but he was really tough, and he was way over the hill when I hit him in my prime.
Bob, I don't recall, and I was glad about it, you having an awful lot of arm trouble. A lot of pitchers today come up with shoulder trouble, arm trouble, so on and so forth. Do you suppose it is because of some faulty pitching habits?
I think it's probably lack of manual labor, where I came up on a farm milking cows, picking corn, following horses in the plowed ground along the field, shocking wheat and doing all that all summer and also in the winter working, building fences and doing all the manual labor as a boy and going to school also. But I don't believe in the ice, only on a bruise or a broken bone or when the ice is, I don't think it hurts him particularly. I don't think it helps him. I always wear a wool sleeve under my shirt sleeve in cool weather. I do not believe in air conditioning for baseball pitchers, and I took a train the night before I was going to start a series. I'd stay off the air-conditioned train and out of the air-conditioned room. I think the Nautilus machines are great, but I think it's a philosophy. Everything is more rural and manual, and I think that stamina that you build up is something you can't do in a gym. It's just our society. I don't blame the young younger pitchers or the present-day ball players. It's just our society is that way, and I think the farm life, or the simple life for a young boy coming up has advantages.
Knowing you as I do, and knowing the great fastball you have, but knowing the kind of person you have, you are, I don't think you ever threw at a hitter.
No, Bob, I never threw at any hitter. I hit a few of them, and I only ever hit two people in the head. One was a high school boy who was looking for the curveball and got the fastball, and one was Hank Lieber in spring training in New Orleans. I threw the curve, it got away from me, and he ducked over the plate thinking it was a fastball. He was a right-hand hitter, and it broke down and hit Hank, who was a fine ball player, a good hitter, and behind...
I remember him well.
Right behind the ear, and it almost ruined his career. But that was a curveball. Of course, a boy I hit in Iowa in the face, he lost an eye. But it was raining that day, and I told the umpire to call the ball game.
You can answer a question that I couldn't answer last night when an old-time baseball fan asked me, who threw the pitch that killed Ray Chapman?
Wasn't that Caldwell? Was it Caldwell? Chapman. Was it Caldwell? He's a pitcher for the Indians in 1920, replaced by Joey Sue. I thought it was... I was named Caldwell. He lived in the Seattle area. I wish I could answer it offhand. You kind of caught me. It was, but I can't think of his first name. His name was Caldwell.
Now, that was a real tragedy at that time.
Yes, it was.
It would be at any time.
Of course, Joey Sewell took his place. Joey Sewell, he's in the Hall of Fame, too. He's a fellow that would never strike out. Of course, he had a brother, Luke, that played around here in Chicago and managed at St. Louis and played in Cleveland. Joey Sewell is the only man in history that ever played on the World Championship College team, the World Championship Minor League team, and the World Championship Major League team all in the same year. That's a little baseball nostalgia.
Bob, Grover Cleveland Alexander was before your time, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. I saw Grover Cleveland Alexander pitch after he left the game for the House of David, an exhibition game in Des Moines. He could still throw pretty good for a couple innings. I knew him quite well.
I remember going up into the clubhouse at Wrigley Field during Alexander's time, and he would roll, get ready to go down to pitch, and he would have they'd roll your own cigarettes in those days. He'd roll a cigarette. He'd take about two puffs. He'd reach up into his locker and get down a bottle of Sloan's liniment. Put it in his left hand, put it on his right shoulder, get his uniform on, leave, and he'd be back in an hour and 24 or 25 minutes. He never walked a soul.
He had great control. He was a great sinker and low ball pitcher, and he had good curves, and he was pretty sneaky, too. He had a great curveball, and he liked Mathis and didn't waste any time out there, and the guy's silent and young, too. But I never saw him in his prime. I read all these great stories, how he relieved against Lazuri for the Cardinals in the World Series in St. Louis when Roger Hornsby was down there. I think Roger was the manager to come and won the ball game. He pitched the next couple innings. He's a great pitcher, and I wish I could have won that many ball games myself.
Our guest today, and we're delighted to have him, is one of the great pitchers of all time, Bob Feller. We'll be back with our guest in just a moment. As a lover of baseball as I am, it's wonderful to have Bob Feller as our guest today because he and I were very dear friends, and I broadcast some of the greatest games he ever pitched. He's here to try to induce everybody listening to get a ballot out and vote for the All-Stars.
This is the largest national balloting or election we have except the presidential election. There's over 12 million votes last year. There's 30 million ballots out. Go to your major league park, minor league park, or any outlet, retail outlet, where Gillette products are featured. Get a ballot. Select the players. If they're not on the ballot, write in your favorite player. Let your conscience be your guide. Be honest. Be fair. And let's have a great All-Star game in Seattle this year.
Bob, thanks so much for being with you.
My pleasure, Bob.
Bob Feller, one of the great pitchers of all time. This fellow was really and truly something, and we've enjoyed ever so much having him as our guest. Remember the cocktail party at Cooperstown. It'll be on the night of August the 4th.
Bob, I told you before, I'm going to fall off the wagon with you.
Thank you very much. Try to get out and see the ball game if you can today. In the meantime, have a happy day. And now this is Bob Elson saying goodbye until next Sunday at our usual time.